Good afternoon, and welcome to the 32nd briefing by the Baker Polito administration to the municipal officials, the municipal CEOs of Massachusetts. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the executive director of the MMA, and it's the MMA's pleasure to serve as the platform host for these regular briefings by Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito and the team from the administration directly to all of you. I'll just go over the normal process, which is Lieutenant Governor will speak. She also has Senior Associate Commissioner of Education, Russell Johnston, who's here and will make a presentation. And then the Heath Failey from the Special Director for Federal Funds and Sean Cronin will be available to give a snapshot on what's happening with revenues, federal funding. And then we'll take questions. At that time in the chat, we won't use the raise hand function, and then we'll go through as many questions as possible. A recording of this briefing will be placed on the MMA website with a summary article, and all of the unanswered questions that are raised in the chat will be shared with the administration so they know what's outstanding in terms of questions from municipal leaders. So with all of that, we thank you again for your leadership and all the efforts that you've been making throughout the course of the pandemic to protect your residents and to move your communities forward during the most difficult of times. So with thanks to the Lieutenant Governor for being here and the partnership with local government, Lieutenant Governor, the floor is now yours. Thank you so much for being here.
Okay, thank you so much, Jeff, for hosting once again. We got the whole band back together to address any questions, concerns, ideas, comments that you have forward to this exchange. And it seems like yesterday we were together, but that was 2 weeks ago. So a lot to go over today. First, it is hard to believe when you look at your calendar, you see the date that was almost a year to the date that the state of emergency issued here in the Commonwealth. And like you, a year ago, we did not expect to be on the 32nd MMA briefing discussing all the matters regarding pandemic and the effects that that's had on our communities of our Commonwealth. But here we are. Here we are. And I just, first and foremost, I am always grateful for the hard work, for the collaboration, for the ingenuity that has been exhibited by the local leaders all across our Commonwealth. It's relentless. The calls upon your time now in a virtual format are all the time, which is really hard to manage when you have your family, your work, and the community all needing your attention. So thank you. Let's start off with sort of where we are. 19 communities are in that red category. That's a lot different than what the Commonwealth looked like when we turned into the new year. That's a real credit to all of you for your continued efforts on communication, awareness, enforcement, testing, all of the things that you're doing. So the virus, you know, seeing that chart with the virus go right down, see our hospitalizations and our ICUs go down. In 1 week, the DCU field hospital will be mothballed and hopefully not reopen again in our future, is all a real testament to your hard work. On the vaccine front, I just want to also share with you good news. When you're talking with your colleagues and your teams back in town halls and city halls, Massachusetts is number one in terms of doses administered per capita for states that are like-sized, over 5 million people in population. That's a really good stat, and it's the reality of where we're at in terms of our vaccination throughput in the Commonwealth. We have received 2.4, a little bit more, doses of vaccine. We've administered a little over 2.1 million doses of vaccine. That translates into 715,136 Massachusetts residents who have been fully vaccinated. That represents about 13% of people who are eligible to receive the vaccine. That's terrific. Where batting average is about an 88% in terms of the doses shipped to the Commonwealth and doses in the arms of the people of our Commonwealth. That's also a really good number. It's like that thermometer you see when you're trying to raise funds locally. We just want to see that go right up to the top. In terms of where the doses go and where they've been administered, I'll just give you sort of a rundown so you can picture in your mind when the vaccines come to the Commonwealth, you know, where are they actually being distributed from. 38% hospitals, 23% the CVS and Walgreens program, 11% mass vac sites, 10% local boards of health and regional collaboratives, and about 5% community health centers. It sort of gives you the sense of volume within each of those avenues. And as we know, we're not at 88% just because of one avenue. We have multiple avenues, multiple places that people can book an appointment for and receive the doses. And be mindful, as you are, that on the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, this is two doses. So it makes it that much more difficult to administer and get people fully vaccinated. And of course, the freezing and refrigeration requirements that complicate that process. As we've all said, we cannot wait for more of the one dose vaccine to rain heavily here on the Commonwealth. We've only received 58,000 J&J doses, and it's been announced to all of us that the J&J manufacturing is not going as quickly as we would like, and there'll be a delay in terms of the fuller amount of that vaccine reaching the Commonwealth, hopefully later in the month when that happens. And the 58,000 doses was kind of like a one-time thing, and just a little bit more coming with that. And most of that's being distributed through the hospitals and health system. Let's start with some of the announcements we made last week, and that was effective March 11th. Our teachers and educators, childcare staff, that whole cohort, which represents about 400,000 people, are eligible to receive vaccines coming this Thursday and after. I mean, that's really terrific news. And we look forward to seeing that set up over the course of these upcoming weeks. We will have more information on the specifics of that relative to the designated days that we will be announcing at our mass vac sites, and hopefully the regional collaboratives will align with that program to have these doses administered to our educators and that group in the upcoming weeks. So I don't have the specifics for you today, but it's coming really soon. So more to come there. In terms of the group, it was about 400,000 that is joining the current eligibility group that's been obviously announced since the beginning of the program, but the 65 plus people with two medical conditions, that was around 1 million people. So where are we in terms of doses administered to that 65 to 75 category? My notes say about 287,000 of that age category have received their first doses. So, you know, about a third of the way through. So we still have a long way to go for that large population. And remember, in that category, you have older people and people with medical conditions where they really need our help. I know Jana sent around an email to the regional collaboratives last Friday. She might want to address some of that in her when she's able to answer some of your questions about local access at regional collaboratives. It would certainly be helpful for the regional collaborative communities to make sure that people within that age category and with those conditions have access to the vaccine. Schools. 80% of our schools are in hybrid or in-person learning, okay? We want everyone to get back. We certainly want the educators and our professionals in the school districts be able to make assessments of our kids before the end of this school year. So important that they lay some eyes on all of these kids. And so DESE will be issuing guidance about the return to school program that they've outlined. That's coming later today. And I believe tomorrow at 11 a.m., there will be a briefing with DESE and the school districts to go into that in more detail. So more to come there. And I'm sure Russell can address any questions that you have on that, as well as pool testing. Pool testing is just one more of those tools we put into the toolbox for school districts to be able to use to get more people comfortable returning back into the classroom for learning. And I'm very proud of the efforts that all of you have made there, because 952 schools are administering weekly COVID tests to nearly 300,000 students, teachers, and staff across the Commonwealth. That's a really incredible effort, Russell and the team, as well as your partners at the local level. And I just want to thank you for continuing that pooled testing to make sure that everyone feels comfortable and safe getting back into the classrooms. In terms of our hardest hit communities, we all know that we've identified 20 as disproportionately impacted. We announced not too long ago $4.7 million of investment in terms of helping to reach the hardest hit within those communities. And using groups like Healthcare for All and Archipelago strategies to develop strategies with these community leaders about what best works for your community. This is not a one-size-fits-all approach. We've often said on this call how you know your community's best, and these sort of groups are available to help you design out the vaccination program, the awareness and educational tools, and the outreach and penetration of the vaccine into these harder to reach areas. And so the survey is being conducted to help you organize that. Just where do we stand with communities of color in these hardest hit communities? We're actually ranked number 2 in the country for the percentage of Black residents that have been vaccinated. We do lead as compared to the national percentages, but they're still clearly not high enough. So there's a lot more work to do in this area. A couple things here. You know that there are liaisons that are assigned to each one of these communities. They're there to help you sort through the challenges and deploy the assets that we have together to reach the communities, the homebound seniors, vaccine hesitancy, and the like. Two things there. Tomorrow, this is sort of a sneak preview, we are announcing the extension of the Stop the Spread testing program that was due to expire in March. It's now going to continue through June. So that will continue to be an asset for all communities. And we are working on data. We've talked about that as a group, about more information for you as community leaders to have relative to doses of vaccine administered to residents within your community, and also a lens of age and ethnicity so that you can better understand where the gaps are, and then again, target the strategies to reach people who have not yet received their doses. Setting benchmarks and goals so that we make sure that there's full access, there's opportunity to receive the vaccine, and then there's a program designed to reach. It could be a mobile vaccine program, for instance, for some of the harder to reach neighborhoods and places. So that's to come as well. We're fine tuning that data and setting it up in a way that's going to be usable for you. It will also include both state and federal doses. So for instance, you might have a CVS in your community that is receiving doses. You would want to know what that program looks like. In terms of our reopening, I think you all know where we are there. I don't have to get into those details. on March 1, moving back into step 2, phase 3. But March 22 will be here before you know it. And that's when the indoor and outdoor stadium venues and other larger venue types will be opening. And the gathering limits will increase to 100 indoors, 150 outdoors. The private settings remain at 10 and 25 for now. And people do ask, and just for the process of what happens next, and we are meeting with various business groups that are in that phase 4 category that want to see restrictions lifted, and assembling the information from them and preparing the proper protocols for further lifting of restrictions and reopening for some of those activities and venues. So more to come there. As you know, we like to see the effects of activity that increases when we do lift restrictions, make sure that we have enough data to study what impact that's had before moving forward. So we just did March 1, March 22, we'll be able to have a little bit more data available to us and then be able to do more. Clearly these longer days and better weather, getting outdoors is going to be important. There's also probably some interest in figuring out locally how you might utilize outdoor dining and what you need to do relative to zoning or local decisions you need to make around making some of that permanent. If you need further guidance on that, we're happy to work through Jeff to do so. A lot of what was permitted last year was tied to our state of emergency and our emergency orders. And there will be an expiration of that emergency declaration at some point, obviously not known at this moment when that will be, but 60 days after that expires, some of those emergency orders and authorizations also expire. So if you're tied to that for certain activities permitted in your community, you might want to begin evaluating what you need to do to make these opportunities permanent in your community, such as outdoor dining and what licenses and permits might need to come with that if you want that to be something included in your offerings locally. Just on recovery and planning ahead, we've talked on this call about the one stop for growth and what an exciting opportunity that is, that we packaged some of the top 10 programs for economic development and putting them into one application that will be becoming available in May. But the expressions are of interest is not a requirement, but that is available for your community to utilize as well. We have already received 27 expressions of interest with communities highlighting the top priorities they have for economic development, and we're reviewing those now. Today, we announced $3 million for site readiness, grants from $50,000 to $880,000, identifying sites in your communities that you want to see higher and better use of. So that those grants went out to 10 communities today. And later on today, we're announcing the local rapid recovery planning grants. And that is exactly what it is. It's local, it's rapid, it's now. So you think about your downtowns and your main streets and how it looked before the pandemic. But there's maybe some reimagining and rethinking about the supports that your downtowns and main streets need in order to fully recover. And that's what this program is designed to do. We have $9.5 million being announced this afternoon to 125 communities, where each of those communities will be assigned a consultant and someone with professional expertise to analyze the conditions in your downtown and what are some of the immediate steps that you can take to help make sure that these local businesses, your downtown returns to a level of robustness that you obviously want to see. So that gives you a sense of where we are at the moment. I'm going to now turn it back over to Jeff, or I can turn it right over to Russell at DESE, who's going to talk a bit about pool testing. Then we'll turn it over to Heath to talk about the finance piece of this. There's a lot happening on the national level, and there's more that you need to track there, which is good news. And of course, the DPH team is here to address questions that you might have relative to the day-to-day stuff that you're managing with all of us. So thank you.
Thank you. That's a great plan. Thank you for all that information. I was scribbling away during it, during your update. Turn it over now to Russell Johnston, Senior Associate Commissioner at DESE, for an update on pool testing. And maybe if you can't give a preview, then talk a little bit about the guidance and school opening, if you can fit that in. Thanks.
Absolutely. Glad to. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Great to be here with you, as always. I really appreciate your interest and support for our public schools. And so just glad to bring you some information and, of course, answer questions as well. So as Lieutenant Governor mentioned, we are really pleased about the kind of the interest and the kind of enrollment that we have in our pool testing program. That number that she quoted, and it continues to go up. Even I have a live dashboard. The number continues to go up actually every day. So we're actually just over 1,000 schools now, because again, this is it. We are, this is active work all across the Commonwealth. Applications come in on a daily basis. And so it's always a moving target in terms of how many schools and districts are participating. So with over 1,000 schools now participating, we have more than half of our schools that are creating this capacity, have this opportunity available, and are working out the details in order to, you know, just get it fully operational and a really key support for bringing more students back. So those of you listening and participating right now, you might have this up and running, or you might still be interested in it and have some questions about it. There are just three things that I want to mention about our pool testing initiative. The first is that the last time that I spoke to you about this, we said that the state would be covering the costs until the end of March. We've actually decided to extend that for 3 additional weeks. So we will be covering the costs through April 18th, and it is definitely not too late to join and to apply. We actually decided not to have a cutoff date for districts to apply. We'll take you at any point that you come. We think that the more that we can do while the state is paying for this initiative to get districts up and running, so that when we stop paying and districts start paying, that we've built the infrastructure. So even if it's just a few weeks that you join our initiative and then end up, you know, taking on the costs, those are weeks that we are covering that overall infrastructure, the startup fees, you know, just the training that's necessary can all be on our dime. And that's what we really want for you. We want that structure to be in place so that it's as sustainable as possible, keeping in mind that once we get to that sustainability level, we're talking about a cost of $3 to $5 per individual per week. So each time that an individual is swabbed, that's $3 to $5 per individual. And with the additional stimulus money that is already available, we think that's very sustainable for the remainder of this school year. The second point that I would just make is that, you know, we've really worked to cover as many of the costs as possible, not all costs. You know, certainly, you know, there's definitely work that the district needs to provide or support they need to add to this. But, you know, we built in sort of, you know, how we cover the standard costs, but then how do we bring in staff if we need on-site collectors of, you know, the pool testing swabs and vials, or do we need somebody to provide oversight at the school level? We can do that. We want to reduce as many barriers as possible for districts to join this important initiative. And the last thing that I'll mention is that we've partnered really closely across state agencies, including our colleagues at DPH and obviously Health and Human Services, that are really working to drive this initiative with us. But also our partners at the Shaw Foundation, and I'll put their website in the chat. But what we've asked Shaw to do is to really collect best practices from across the state, because there is a lot of problem solving that has to go into this. This is breaking new ground. We've never done this in public education before. And so let's not have every district have to reinvent the wheel on this. And so their website is really where we funnel all good ideas to. We're so pleased by the innovation and ingenuity that's happening in the state. So, you know, and I think it really brings us to the reopening guidance, because what we see with all of these districts participating in pool testing right now is the mitigation strategies are working. We see that schools are safe places for learning. And so it really gives us this confidence to talk about reopening schools. And so I appreciate, you know, the ability to talk to you a little bit about the guidance that's actually coming to you this hour. So all of our representatives who are on our email list from MMA will be getting our guidance materials before 2 o'clock about reopening schools. And, you know, just some quick highlights from it. You know, we really talk about the rationale, why this is the right time, how much the science really bears out that the types of, you know, the bringing students in at the spacing or the physical distancing requirements that we're setting forth, that minimum of 3 feet, the 3 feet really can be a safe standard, is fully endorsed so strongly by our medical community, by the WHO. And we just know that, you know, this is with the data that we have from districts that are already doing this, that schools are very much safe places for our students and for our teachers. And so a few key things to point out from the document itself that, again, you'll be seeing, just calling it up here for myself real quick, that you will you know, notice that we talk about the dates. So keep in mind that you've already heard us talk about elementary coming back on April 5th. Our middle school students, what you'll see in this document for grades 6 through 8, will be looking at a return date of April 28th. And so that's probably important to keep in mind right now. High school students will announce details about the timing of a high school phase in April. So look for an April decision about when we would be talking about high school students coming back. Really key thing, obviously, is surveying our families right now. And what I need everyone to get their heads around with the survey is we need to ask all families. If you're, for example, all families have two directions they can go. So if you're a family that chose a remote model right now, you might decide that you want to come in or stay remote. So two options for those families. If you are a family right now that's participating in a hybrid model, and so pleased that, you know, many of our districts, like the Lieutenant Governor said, 80% of our districts right now at least offering hybrid, many offering full in-person, that those families, if they're in a hybrid model, also have to be surveyed. Do you want to now extend and progress towards the all in-person model or change to a remote model? And we just hope that as many will come in that full in-person model as possible. There's some details about the applicable grades. Some of you might have different grade configurations. And so, you know, if you're not a traditional kind of K-5 elementary model, we work to address that in our guidance. We talk about the need for a school committee vote. That's really a local decision, but it relates a lot to whether or not you might submit a waiver, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. Some of you might have learning enrichment centers where students can go to access remote learning right now. So we give guidance about how to transition, frankly, those models out right now so that we can have more students in person, in front of teachers in our schools. And we're so happy about that. Also, just want to reference the transportation guidance that we put out a few weeks ago that significantly expands bus capacity as being very important and a really key equation for returning our students to more in-person learning. And one of the final things that I'll mention before I go to the waiver is that we're changing our mask wearing requirement, our mask guidance, that it should apply to all grade levels. And again, we just know how much mask wearing is such the really a cornerstone of the mitigation strategies in our schools. We see how well it works. And so asking for mask wearing across all grade levels is so important. And I also want to just reassure you that we're working really closely with our partners at Early Education and Care to make sure that there's consistency in this guidance, because, you know, you are also, as mayors or as city officials, working with town managers, working with a variety of stakeholders, including businesses that run after school programs for students. So we're really trying to make this as consistent as possible, because we so believe that these are the safe ways that we can provide services and supports for students. So the final thing that I'll say is there is a waiver process that we detail in this plan, in this guidance that's coming out to you again within this hour. And thinking about a very limited set of circumstances where districts might make a compelling case that they need to take a more incremental approach to implementing these requirements. And so we kind of spell out what those circumstances might look like and the process for submitting a waiver. But it's very much our hope that, you know, we begin with how can we get more students safely back in our schools because we know it's possible, and then determine if we need a waiver, as opposed to starting with, you know, what might we need to waive in order to maintain what we have. We really want a brighter day. We want a future day for our students where they are much more robustly in front of our teachers in our schools. And we're excited to partner with you to make that happen. So glad to take any questions that you might have. And thank you so much for your support of this important initiative.
Thanks, Russell. I do see a couple of questions, but what we'll do is I think we'll hear from Heath and Sean and then go back and start to go through the questions if that's okay with you.
Sounds great.
Great. Heath, you're up.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks, Jeff, and everybody for joining us today. Wanted to give a brief update on the progress of the American Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, as it's working its way through the Congress. You may have seen that it passed the United States Senate on Saturday. Bill text came out just a little while ago, about an hour ago. And then the U.S. House of Representatives is supposed to take up the bill again, either later this evening or seems like perhaps more likely tomorrow at this point. But $1.9 trillion package has an awful lot of pieces and components in it, many of which are still being sort of unpacked. But for state and local governments, clearly the most notable component is the $350 billion in assistance, direct assistance from the federal government to state and local governments associated with sort of pandemic response. So just sort of for a little bit of context, that $350 billion is split between state governments and local governments across the country, with about $200 billion for states and $130 billion for municipalities, for local governments, and then a smaller portion for tribal governments and territories. Our expectation in terms of the local allocation is that it would be $65 billion for municipalities and $65 billion for counties. So that's the 130 that I talked about. The rough estimates that we've seen, the preliminary estimates that we've seen, suggest that that translates into about $8 billion for Massachusetts or for municipalities and counties in the Commonwealth and state. The numbers that we have seen are still pretty preliminary, I would say, and so there's still you know, once we sort of unpack the final version of the bill, we'll get have a clearer sense of what the allocations are going to look like for the states and for individual cities and towns. In terms of eligible uses, the uses are, this is for local governments, similar to what was in the Coronavirus Relief Fund from the CARES Act from a year ago, but the expenses need to be necessary or need to spend necessary as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. There are other eligible uses specified in the bill. Those include, and this is the Senate version that passed on Saturday, seems like it's on its way to becoming law. The premium pay for public workers is an eligible use. You know, sort of more details on that to come as we unpack it. And also an ability to use these funds for certain investments in infrastructure related to water, sewer, and broadband. In terms of covered period, you know, so the funds will be available to use until December 31st, 2024. So a fairly long period of time to be able to use the funds, to deploy the funds. For local governments, there are going to the payouts will be over the course of two tranches, with half of the funds allocated to your community will come. So the Treasury will pay the state within 60 days, and then we'll distribute to municipalities within a further 30 days. So something like 90 days from now will be the first tranche, about 50% of your allocation. And then the second tranche, the second 50% of that allocation will be made to you in 1 year. So 12 months from the date of the original payment. So spread out over a couple of years with what I would describe as sort of broader eligible use categories. You are able to use a portion of the funds for revenue replacement. You know, still a little bit of analysis to do on this, but it looks like from the text of the bill that the comparison point for calculating revenue loss will be your fiscal year 2019 revenue amount. So 2019 versus 2020 or 2021 to be able to calculate that amount of revenue replacement amount. But again, still a lot of details to flesh out on that point. So I am certain that we will have much more information for you all as we go forward. You know, once the bill becomes law, and then once the United States Department of the Treasury issues further guidance about how to deploy and to use those funds in an eligible way. You know, there'll also be reporting requirements and you know, transparency requirements, this sort of thing. So a lot of details still to come, but you know, there's a significant amount of money coming our way, and you know, with a lot of opportunities and a lot of you know, a lot of responsibilities associated with that as well. So, Jeff,
thanks, Heath, and you're right about how this is changing, because the draft that had been available of the Senate bill appears to have changed between in just the last hour and a half when the text became available. There's the premium pay language was added, and the language regarding dealing with the economic impacts of the pandemic is hard to see where that is right now, and that's a critical aspect of how communities could deploy the funds. So we'll also be looking for a very wide latitude and from the Department of Treasury's allowable uses of the funds, because otherwise that might not be as favorable a development in terms of allowable uses. And that was a surprise, I'll say, that when we saw that just about an hour ago, in terms of the change of use. So a lot of money, it's great news, but we look forward to working with you on the rules and making sure that communities can make maximum use of the funds to address those most impacted. So thanks very much, Heath, for that update. Lieutenant Governor, I turn it back to you. We will start to take questions in the chat function, and I'll take that now. We encourage you, if you're putting questions in the chat, to address them to panelists and attendees so everyone else can see the questions. But we'll start to go through all of them. So Lieutenant Governor, the first question is, many residents have heavily invested in expanded dining areas. The current executive order, I think you mentioned this, can the executive order be amended to read that the expansion of seating could be in effect through January 1, 2022 and other aspects, or this is about the adjustments that were made under your executive order for restaurants and seating and dining. You then made mention of this to start planning now for when the executive order expires, because once the executive order is not, once there's not a public health emergency, you're not going to be able to override or provide these in executive order form.
Right. Just to be clear, there is no date or decision relative to the declaration of the state of emergency and the executive orders associated with this topic in particular. So having said that, that's uncertain. But if you want to, as a community, be certain about the areas that you incorporated into your sort of local recovery relative to outdoor dining and permitting the off-premises dining that's outside of the traditional way that you allow for these activities to occur, and you're relying on the governor's executive order that will expire and go away someday, whether it's 60 days after the executive order is taken down, or even if it were to be extended to January 1, 2022, I don't have an answer for you on that. It still leaves uncertain for you whether or not that provision will be a permanent feature that you offer. So you might want to analyze what zoning amendments you would need to undertake with your town meeting or your city council in order to make some of those off-premises activities permanent. You might also want to look at your liquor licensing and determine if any of those processes need to be changed. And obviously ABCC continues to be involved in that process. We can give you, Jeff, some of the analysis that our legal team has made, and you can provide that to members as you see fit. But without answering directly, because I don't have an answer as to whether or not we would extend it, because we don't have a date that we've determined it would expire. But you should perhaps undertake an analysis of what you think works for your dining establishments and what you want to see become a permanent offering in your community.
Great, thank you very much. There's a question, it looks like it's addressed to Heath and Sean. And this has to do with some of the preliminary numbers that are coming out of the American Rescue Plan. And I think this question has to do with what from this, from the questioner's perspective is an inequity, because there are some communities that are receiving larger amounts of money, the communities that are known as the metropolitan cities or the CDBG entitlement communities are getting a some amount of money. And then the other communities in Massachusetts are getting a per capita distribution, which is a smaller per capita amount on average than what the entitlement communities are. Do you have any insight into that? The question here is, would the state consider stepping in with its own share of the funds to help those communities who can demonstrate the real need but are receiving less? Would that be a use of money?
I think it's too early, right? I mean, I think over the past month that the House or the Senate have been putting out these calculations, I mean, I've shared them with Sean. I think there's been like 12 of them or something like this, right? So like there's just been lots of calculations that have been done, and every time the calculations happen, they change. So I think it's too early to comment on, distribution and allocations and all that kind of stuff. Once we see what's actually in the legislation, then I think it'll be a better time to think about how to adjust accordingly.
Right. And the way the legislation's written is it does not have the allocations in the bill. It actually gives it to the Department of Treasury, the Treasury Department, to make the final assertion of what the allocation is. Right. Under the construct of the bill. So we still have a process after it's signed.
So, yep.
A question for Russell Johnston. Commissioner Riley confirmed last night that we can send children back more quickly than the dates you mentioned. Can you confirm this? And the recommendation is that be put into your written guidance or made clear so that there are some communities, the local officials want to move faster than the guidance, and they're asking for clarification that's allowed under what you are requiring.
Yeah, we appreciate that very much. It's a little late on the guidance if it's not in there, and I'll go back and double check. We could certainly reiterate it with our superintendents when we meet with them tomorrow, as the Lieutenant Governor mentioned, tomorrow at 11, when we're going over the guidance with them. And we are so pleased about districts like Cohasset, that announced that they're returning to full in-person starting March 1st, long before our board took any action. Hanover is at 4 days a week. We just see that there is a groundswell in the state to get more students back in front of teachers. And that was happening all on its own. We fully endorse that. We fully embrace it and want to see it happen. And maybe I'll just take a minute though, and I appreciate the reference to the meeting that the commissioner had with a group of city and town leaders yesterday. Also thinking though about what happens for communities that don't implement these new requirements. Keep in mind that what we really most want is for students to be with their teachers. And so if we don't meet the student learning time requirements during the remainder of this school year, then the requirement would be that the school year would have to extend. We would have to somehow make up those hours for our students, because frankly, that's our responsibility to them, to provide them with quality instruction. Keep in mind that we do have the ability to look to Chapter 70 funds. That is in law already that allows us to look at that. We hope not to have to go there. We don't want to be looking at a funding kind of consequence from this. We want a learning consequence from this. And so, there are options on the table for, districts that struggle to be able to comply with this. But we hope that we can provide technical assistance, get as many districts up and running by April 5th as possible, and then encourage those districts that are ready to start even sooner to do that and to really show them as examples for others in the state of what's possible and what we can do for our children.
Great. Thank you very much. And Lieutenant Governor, next question, I'll pop back up because the last question was divided in two bubbles because it was as the person was sending it, somebody else jumped in between with a question. So this one is, with the March 11th date for school employee vaccination eligibility coming up very quickly, how do we manage expectations when we're hearing we won't be able to schedule appointments for some time because of a lack of vaccine availability, because there's a static amount coming in from the federal government, still far below the actual amount that we could either use or need from the federal government in terms of vaccines coming in? How do we manage expectations at the local level for how long it will take to get appointments in the vaccine?
Right. So we obviously went forward with the 65 plus people with two medical conditions before knowing that the Biden-Harris administration would ask the states to have teachers vaccinated. But as soon as they did, we obviously adopted and aligned with the federal provision so that teachers are now also, and staff as well as childcare providers to align with the feds, are also eligible within that category. So now we all know that's a lot of people. That's the million, which we're about a third of the way through, plus the 400,000. So we're still around a million. And we don't have additional doses. What we do have is about 150,000 doses that we are receiving from the feds for our weekly allocation to distribute. Now, what the feds are doing is adding doses to the CVS program, and those are being dropped at a cadence that we don't have a whole lot of insight into. But there are additional doses coming through the CVS program from the feds for educator vaccination. What we said when we announced that educators in that cohort would be eligible for vaccines March 11th, that we would be announcing specifics relative to dates certain for our mass vac sites. And we strongly encourage regional collaborations to align with what we're doing at the mass vaccination sites for teacher specific days for vaccination. That information is coming very soon, like this week, and we'll provide you with more details around access to vaccine through the channels that we coordinate, mass vac sites and you as local boards of health and your collaborations regionally have stood up. So more to come. I don't have it all for you right at the moment, but more to come. And we'll work very closely with Jeff to make sure that the information is provided to you and prepare for that. Jana, you might have more that you'd like to offer there, because there was a communication that you distributed last Friday that addresses a different issue, which we were hearing from many of you that the regional collaborations were being crashed into by people from other locations in the Commonwealth and eating up capacity for people within that region to be able to access doses. And that's something that Jana wanted to address, and she sent a communication out on Friday, and you might want to elaborate on that, Jana.
Sure, thank you. So it really is a tremendous amount of work to run a clinic, and we recognize there were, there was really great, community effort to run these regional sites. They're open to everybody, but we were hearing, yes, quite repeatedly that, people would work to stand up a clinic, and they would do, and they were quite happy to have the sites open for everybody, but that frequently, they weren't seeing kind of a local representation in some of these clinic appointments. And so what we did on Friday is we let the regional collaborations know that they could take 25% of the allocation of vaccine that they have received, that they receive each week, and they could do local work with that vaccine. So, this might be a way for the, and it's to serve the regional collaboration. So if there are multiple towns in the regional collaboration, if there's a county in the regional collaboration, however it works, that vaccine can be used to do some local work. So perhaps there are still some senior clinics or, individuals over the age of 75 that have been having a hard time getting vaccinated. This would be a good use of that 25% of the vaccine. Perhaps there are some other efforts that could be done with that, that really kind of make sure that, there's some local benefit for all of the local work that's being done. And then the remaining 75% of that vaccine is still available statewide and public clinics and everything. But it really tried to balance out the fact that, each time we would hear from somebody, they felt like there were still some people to serve locally. And so this, we hope, enables both of those things to happen.
And there is a question a little later in the chat on this. It just said that, if there's a community that maybe not, that may be right next to the collaborative, that 25% is only being used for those in the regional collaborative and communities next to it, they might have decided to join the collaborative functionally if they knew that then there was going to be a set aside for those that were actually doing it. So there's just some concern about that.
It's not too late for them to reach out to the lead community and see if they can work together.
Okay. Thank you. Great. Let's see, I'll go back up. There's a question, Heath, is the funding coming, federal ARPA funding coming jointly from municipalities and school districts, or will we see it split like the CARES and ESSER, but because there is money in there for reopening schools, for example, but that's a separate pool, right?
Yeah, there's another tranche of ESSER in there. So the third would be ESSER 3, $130 billion worth of additional ESSER funds that would go to school districts on a formulaic basis. There have been two previous rounds, $185 million and $735 million. And so then, sense of scale, I would sort of put you in the sort of 2X over your ESSER 2. But there'll be, a dedicated stream of funding for your local school district.
Thank you, Heath. Here's a question, another one on vaccines. It's a two-part question. I'll summarize it. The first is, when supply becomes adequate and there's enough coming from the federal government, would you consider allowing for municipal clinics and municipalities to start to receive doses again? That's the first part. And then the second part is, will those communities partnering with local health clinics receive second dose allocations when the first doses have already been administered locally?
I need some help from Jenna on this, but my understanding was that if a local clinic provided a first dose, that they would get their second doses. We That's certainly correct. Don't want people wondering now where do they have to go to get their second dose. That is something we would not want to see. So you get your second dose if you provided the first dose. Is that correct, Jenna?
It is, yes. And, you know, people have been, we're doing second doses now, kind of the way these work, you know, every 3 to 4 weeks, you go through that four dose or that second dose cycle. And there are a lot of plans in place for second dose clinics through March. So we're really trying to work hard to make sure people get us their second doses as close to that 28 days as possible. But we also know the CDC says there's some totally feasible extension of that time frame. So it may be the next week, but it's still, we are absolutely committed to getting communities their second doses, and also the other providers who may have administered the first dose. We want to make sure people can go back.
And in terms of avenues to provide the vaccine, we have a lot of them, right? We have hospitals receiving the lion's share of doses coming into the Commonwealth. We have our MassVac sites and our regional collaboratives that are receiving about the same. We have our CHCs for targeted interventions in community. You have your retail pharmacies that are also receiving an allocation from the federal government. And you will see more providers receiving doses of vaccine that will be able to address patient panels. And when you think about the J&J vaccine, when that does come with the more consistent administration rate to our Commonwealth, that will provide a lot more opportunity because it's a one dose and it won't be as intensive as scheduling a second appointment, making sure it's within the time of the first appointment and the refrigeration and the freezer. So we'll be developing our ideas around how to allocate that judiciously so that we continue to have high throughput and a high administration rate in our Commonwealth.
Thank you. We only have a couple minutes left, so we'll sort of move through quickly what we can. And then again, for those questions we can't get to, we will save the chat and share it with your team, Lieutenant Governor. A couple questions about the sector-specific guidance being issued for phase four. Do you have a timing of that? And then this is from a local official who's interested in making sure that there's guidance, specific guidance about the indoor meeting capacity and the protocols, and if that's available, because I'm sure they're imagining having a select board meeting or a municipal yeah. meeting and how to organize that.
I think ANF and Sean Cronin's group and MMA, you're all working together on those thoughts about meetings in the future for municipalities. In terms of phase four, that begins step one on March 22nd. There are no industry-specific protocols because the large venues are submitting their plans directly to DPH for approval. As we wade deeper into phase four, and there are specific business categories that will require industry protocols, we will be preparing those.
Thank you. There's a question regarding, can the ARPA funds be used for revenue replacement? Based on the yes, but the Treasury Department will be further defining what counts as revenue replacement. Question with regards to outdoor dining, some communities are already in preparation for annual town meetings, with some communities already having their town meeting warrants closed. I share this, strongly request or urge the governor to look toward a January 1, 2022 expiration date to help communities begin its work, work with residents and boards through this year's, through the whole process for next year as well.
I will take that back to legal to determine what's possible there. What I'm hearing from all of you is you need the flexibility. These are initiatives that are really helping your restaurants and local shops and your downtowns and main streets, and you'd hate to see that disrupted, certainly in the good weather months. So let me take that back and see what's feasible.
Excellent. And also there's a plug by the same person to extend the remote meeting and the other options going forward, because they've seemed to work really well, pandemic notwithstanding. So, okay. And we look forward to working with you on that.
Okay, very good.
This is, I think, the last question we can get to. Just a question on how, and this is for Russell Johnston, how will DESE's efforts to have school districts return to full in-person learning be impacted by some teachers' unions' resistance to returning in person?
Thanks, Jeff. It's an important question and one that we really wanted to help to address by moving our board meeting up to give you as much time, to give negotiating teams as much time to work through these issues with their locals as possible in order to have that successful return to school for all of our elementary students on April 5th. And so what we really tried to do is to maximize that negotiating time and to give very clear direction to say that this is the expectation, this is what we have to negotiate towards so that we get people to the table kind of with clear guidance that's just coming out this afternoon, a clear directive, and also just the clear consequence that if this doesn't happen, then that means that we have to extend the school year longer in order to provide our students with the education that they deserve. So there's kind of no way around the bargaining that needs to happen, the negotiating that needs to happen. But we've hoped that we've equipped districts with the time to do it, with, you know, a month before this goes into full operation, as well as the guidance in order to what they're negotiating towards.
Okay, as always, everything's more complicated when you dig down deeper into the details. So thank you for that. Lieutenant Governor, we've reached a little over an hour, so we want to say thank you very much. Any final words for your team, from your team?
Right, there's a lot of changes, right? And change comes with a lot of effort for all of us to work together. And I know this is an enormous undertaking for all of you. As we make changes and decisions, you've got to sort through those details and you've got to implement. So I know that that's a lot to take on. And you've been doing that all the way through this year. There are a number of questions still in the chat. So we will make sure that those are addressed with Jeff so that the information flows back to all of you. And thank you again for your hard work, and we will continue to communicate and collaborate. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. It is amazing. The days seem really long. The year has passed, I guess, quickly, in the sense that who would have thought that this was going to be a pandemic that was not solved or beaten back after a few months. And here we are. There's light at the end of the tunnel, and a lot of collaboration and work between you and your administration and the local officials of Massachusetts. Very complicated issues. And we thank you so much for not only these briefings, but for being available to work on these challenging questions with no easy answers. We appreciate your leadership very, very much. And thank you to all of our local officials. A recording of this briefing will be placed on the MMA website, along with a summary article. As the Lieutenant Governor said, we'll be sharing the unanswered, unasked questions with the administration for them to be able to get back to you. And we look forward to joining you again in 2 weeks with another briefing from the administration and hopefully continued progress. In fact, we're confident of it. So, Lieutenant Governor, thank you very much. And to the whole team, thank you for all of the work that you are doing in all of the various areas in state agencies that you're representing. Your public service is deeply appreciated. We look forward to seeing you well. In the meantime, we wish you safety, health, and some level of lower stress. Take care.
Thank you, everybody. Be well. Bye-bye.